Dabney. And also thanks to Maman, I'm going to be discussing another aspect of some work that we've been doing together in eastern Burma, and Maman has very nicely laid out the context for us, so we won't have to talk about that, which is great. I'm with the Center for Public Health and Human Rights at Johns Hopkins, and we've been collaborating with organizations such as the Backpack Health Worker Team and other organizations in eastern Burma for a number of years now. What we're going to do today, or what I'm going to do, is describe a project that was carried out in collaboration with many of our partners in eastern Burma between 2005 and 2009. It's called the MUM Project, and the aim of this project was to deliver maternal health interventions to some of these internally displaced populations that we just heard about in the previous session. So one of the main areas of work for our center for public health and human rights has been to develop methods to try and understand the relationship between human rights exposure at the population level, at the household level, and then health outcomes at those levels as well. But we're often, and we've done quite a bit of work in that area, and still a lot of work to do, I think, but one of the questions that we also want to ask further on then is how in those settings, once we can get a handle on measuring that type of exposure, how can we use that to our advantage to actually design and adapt public health programs so that they might actually be able to mitigate potentially the impact of those rights violations on the health outcomes. And that's in a sense what we were focused on with the MUM project. The MUM project was a multi-ethnic collaboration. The goal was to improve access to essential maternal health services amongst displaced populations. And there were two sort of main themes running through the way we thought about, in collaboration with our colleagues, the design and implementation of this project. And that was to really recognize the rights of the communities to have a say in how this type of program would be designed, and to think about the rights of communities in terms of not just better health, but also access to information, improved education, etc. And so along with that, a big focus of our project was on capacity building and empowering communities and the organizations we were working with to adapt in their particular areas in ways that they thought were appropriate. The idea here was to think about some of the constraints that Maman has just described in these settings and ask, given global recommendations or regional recommendations about how maternal health care and neonatal health care should be delivered, how should we adapt? How do we make adaptations to those guidelines? And so some of the things we were considering were the fact that there wasn't not a possibility to have permanent structures or facilities where you could then promote facility-based care. There was a lack of security to enable the setting up of these types of facilities. And there's very long transit time, so that wouldn't solve problems of access. So we were really thinking about how do we create a approach that brings services to community members and is very mobile. And we wanted, therefore, also because of the different contexts within which these communities are existing, we wanted the providers to have a very flexible toolkit. So we thought we were thinking about multiple tiers of workers. So what did we do in this project? We targeted, in collaboration with four ethnic health leadership committees in Shan State, in Karen State, Karen, and in Mon State, we targeted about 12 or 13 communities to participate in this pilot project. And they were very variable in terms of their security status, their distance from population centers, their distance from Thailand, etc. But all of them were communities that had well-documented evidence of human rights violations ongoing in these populations. There were three main aims. One was to build capacity among the organizations. One was to deliver the intervention. And the third aim was to produce information that could be helpful for other settings. So what lessons could be learned from this type of approach in a highly constrained setting? We came up with this idea of a multi-tiered network of providers, and the network has three levels. Sort of base level of the largest number of workers really is traditional birth attendants that were existing in these communities, and the idea was to bring them into this project and work with them and really have traditional birth attendants be empowered to be more of a link directly between the community members that they were very close to, and the next level, which we called health workers. So they were the next highest level workers. The health workers, also from the communities, were charged with managing and helping the TBAs. They would deliver some elements of antenatal care and postnatal care, and also some very minimal elements of basic emergency obstetric care. In fact, their focus was mainly on the provision of misoprostol, which covers the provision of a uterotonic aspect of emergency obstetric care, and also the provision of antibiotics for sepsis. So those were the two elements of emergency obstetric care that that level was focused on. And then at the top in each of these communities was the highest tier, mobile obstetric medics. And these individuals were trained to have overall management of the program, but to provide the highest level of care. And I'll go through some of those particular interventions in a moment. So it was very much the set of interventions that were provided was very much based on, you know, a common sort of global and regional guidelines for what should be delivered in terms of maternal and neonatal care. So the TBA tier were really focused on what we would call sort of the essential newborn care package or the essential components of counseling in antenatal care. Things like iron deworming, promoting clean delivery, clean cord cutting. They received some training on very basic elements of resuscitation, just tactile stimulation, for example, neonatal care counseling. The second tier was more, in a sense, what you might think of sort of the outreach-type community-based interventions, where there's a sort of formal structure of workers that would provide things like malaria screening, syphilis screening in pregnancy, some of those essential type of commodity-based type testing interventions in pregnancy. And again, as I mentioned, two of the elements of obstetric care. And then the mobile obstetric medics at the top, the MHWs, they were actually trained in five of the six components of emergency obstetric care, plus blood screening and transfusion. And they also were responsible for delivering a variety of family planning products and counseling for the community. The way this project was monitored was with a number of methods, or it was a mixed methods approach. We used both quantitative and qualitative. Each year of the implementation phase, so 2006, 2007, and late 2008, early 2009, we did large quantitative surveys, cluster-based surveys in these areas to really get a quantitative estimate of the coverage of these interventions and whether they were ramping up now that we had built in these this multi-tiered network. It was also aimed at looking at the human rights violations that were going on in those communities and trying to get an understanding whether or not this adapted approach could, in effect, overcome some of these relationships that we'd, these strong associations that we'd previously seen, such as the examples that Maman provided us. There was also some review of pregnancy forms, and there was some pictorial data collection from TBAs, etc. The qualitative information was largely focused on in-depth interviews with the providers themselves. We actually didn't have an opportunity to do in-depth interviews with the recipients of the care. The IDIs and the focus group discussions were actually done when the workers would come back to Thailand for some periodic refresher training, and that was when we actually did some of the some of those interviews. We, of course, would have liked to do some qualitative work with the recipients, but in fact, we got some very rich information from these community providers, and I think it's a voice, in fact, that's rarely heard. And I'll show you just very briefly one quote that we have and point you in the direction of some reading if you're interested in hearing their voices to greater depth. So if we think about, you know, what did we actually measure when we started the program to get an understanding of baseline coverage, we looked at, you know, some of the essential pieces of effective antenatal care, for example, you know, the number of visits, but not just the number. What was actually done? Was urine tested? Was blood tested? Was a woman screened for malaria, etc.? And you can see that overall in this population, it was very poor. And the most dramatic negative indicator or poor indicator there was the level of skilled care in the last pregnancy, about 5.1%. And that was overall. If we looked actually at the Karen subset, which made up about half, in fact, it was more than half of the population, you know, the access to skilled care was just tremendously low. About 2% of women reporting that they delivered in the context or in the presence of someone who was trained to handle emergencies and complications of delivery. And so this was, again, one of the key things that we wanted to change. We also found extremely high unmet need for contraceptives in this population, about 60%, about 25% actively delaying pregnancy, but a huge gap in terms of unmet need, about 60% there. The human rights violations, we actually saw them in all of the areas. I'm showing the ones from the Karen area since it was the biggest subset, and they are qualitatively different from area to area. Some of that's based on the comments that Maman made about ceasefire versus non-ceasefire areas. That results in sort of qualitatively different types of violations. But in this particular period, we found in the Karen areas forced displacement to be the most common type of violation. In the Kareni areas, for example, it was forced labor with about a quarter of the population, and in the Shan areas, it was about 25% of households for both displacement, forced labor, and the last one here on the list, the food insecurity type violations. Even though access to all of those sort of basic interventions was very low at baseline, we were still able to see that among households that had exposure to violations, their access was even lower. And we were able to show very strong associations, quantitative associations between women from households that had this type of exposure and their actual access to things like ANC visits or receipt of some of the core interventions during pregnancy. Those were very strongly associated with forced relocation, which makes sense in many ways, and also anemia, for example, which again makes sense in terms of food security violations at the household level. Before I get to some of those quantitative results of what did the program actually achieve, when we did many of the IDIs and the focus group discussions with the workers, we were able to capture many important case studies for which were helpful for in terms of sharing with the other groups of workers. There was this complicated case, and this is the community-based solution that was found. But we also were able to, we heard some very disturbing comments, such as the one that I've illustrated here, which really speak again to this sort of context, a very harsh context of human rights violations that's ongoing. If you're interested again to hear more of these voices, which I think are very rich, there's a paper in Social Science and Medicine that illustrates some of these case studies and gives some more interesting context and important context to understand this setting. The program in terms of increasing coverage to interventions was very successful, and it was successful across all of the different, the four states or sub-regions that this project was implemented in. You can see some of the changes here where we compare some of those baseline levels that I showed before with the levels of ANC coverage at end line. The total number is less in the end line survey. The actual surveys were done with the same size, but at the baseline we asked about all pregnancies in the previous 5 years. In the end line we asked about all the pregnancies during the mum period. We also looked at during the mum a similar 2 year period for baseline and found about the same types of changes. But you can see some very large increases in coverage of these types of interventions, in many cases doubling, tripling, or quadrupling the coverage of interventions. Of course, they were starting from a very low level as well. Postnatal care also improved. Basic interventions that we can achieve for the newborn, things like a postnatal care visit within the first days of life, or skin-to-skin contact. Early breastfeeding initiation, which actually was very good at baseline as well, so no quantitative change there. Some even more important key results, I think, were what this project was able to do in terms of increasing coverage to family planning supply. So there was actually an 84% increase in the use of modern contraceptive methods. Now, remember, I think it was about 25% that I quoted, so that means it went up to less than 50% still. But that reflected a reduction in unmet need of about 35%, which is actually, I think, quite impressive for a two-year program in getting these contraceptives out there. So I think that's one of the most important results. And I think the one that's probably most important is to what degree was this top tier of maternal health workers, the ones that were trained to deliver the interventions that make up the components of basic emergency obstetric care, to what degree were those workers able to reach the pregnant women and be present and therefore be able to respond to emergencies? That really increased from about 5% at baseline to about half the women during the MOM project having one of those MHWs there. So that's about a tenfold increase in what we would consider skilled care in this setting. Still a lot of improvement to be made there, but I also think a very important increase. We looked at, in the end line, were human rights violations still associated with coverage? And we found, in fact, that there was still there was less success in terms of the total absolute levels of coverage in households that reported the same types of violations that had been reported at baseline, but we found that the exposed and non-exposed had similar relative improvements, which I think was an important thing. So I think to some degree this adaptation, the mobility of these workers, was able to, in a sense, reduce or mitigate the impact of violations. So we often talk in our center about, well, you know, yes, we can measure these types of associations between human rights violations and health. Is the approach to remove the health violation, or the human rights violation, that's ideal, that's what we all want to do. But in the meantime, can public health programs be designed to mitigate the impact of them? And that's really, I think, what we're seeing with this program. Huge challenges, of course, as you can imagine in this short talk, I think, do justice to those types of challenges. But things like one of the sites being burned completely to the ground right at the beginning of the project, and the entire sort of multi-tiered network moving with the community to an adjacent area and continuing to provide services. Sporadic fighting throughout, which had some negative impact on the ability of the tiered network to provide services. At the end line period, we couldn't evaluate one of the areas. It was completely lost to evaluation because the site was no longer accessible. So things like that. And movement of workers back to our base in Thailand for training was very difficult and is always a logistical challenge. Overall supervision was less than what we would have liked because it's difficult, again, to go into these areas and have the community leadership provide some kind of external monitoring. That would have been very difficult for them to do. So some future plans of this type of project. I mean, I think, the project can broaden the use and the level of worker that could deliver things like prophylactic misoprostol. We could look at extending to more newborn services. If we can provide injectable antibiotics to moms, we can certainly do that for newborns. That's been shown in numerous community-based settings in South Asia. Extending family planning beyond reproductive age women. So this project, the community groups decided that in the initial stage of ramping up family planning, which is controversial in some circles in these communities, they wanted to focus on reproductive age women, but there are other groups that could benefit. So there's, a desire, I think, to extend that. Broadening the types of interventions, as I mentioned, moving to skilled workers. And as Sandra has pointed out for us, there's a broader definition of reproductive health. So there are other pieces that this project of reproductive health that this project didn't focus on, gender-based violence, and there are some people here who probably know more about the progress with which gender-based violence issues are being addressed in this particular community at this stage. I think this is an example of a setting where unbundling the provision of essential services from facilities into communities is absolutely essential. And this is the type of community where making mobility of provision of services is a very critical piece. It demonstrates that basic elements of emergency obstetric care can be provided at the community level, and that you can dramatically increase coverage to skilled care in some of the most constrained settings. So I think those are some of the important conclusions that we've had here. There has been quite a bit written on the MUM project in the last few years. If you're interested, and I'm not sure if people have access to slides, but there are a number of web links and papers that have been published to get more information if you're interested. And this obviously was a huge undertaking with lots of partners, so I wanted to thank all the different people, including partners on the ground, colleagues at different centers, technical advisors, and funders. Thank you.